Okay, so then I will start with an overview of strong field electron motion. Of course, we had already some talks, so I will concentrate on the first step of the ionization. And I have chosen this add-on to the title, the first step in imaging or the first step of imaging, because depending on whether you consider imaging by high harmonics or rescattered electrons, the first ionization step is the first step of imaging, yeah, or in imaging. And but however, you can also consider the direct ionization or the direct electrons as a direct imaging tool. And since we had already some talks, and we will be having some talks on high harmonics, I'm sure, I will not go at all into the high harmonics. I will just, of course, show the famous picture once, but then I will just leave this behind. So the idea is to speak about, the motivation will be short time resolved imaging. I will practically not give, but just remind you, or those who came later. Then I will speak about atomic intense laser field models and their validity. And then the main focus will be on the extension to molecular systems. And there I have some topics, and I will probably not manage to go through all of them, so I will have to see how I manage. One is the R dependence of ionization. This I would like to discuss also because I promote here a control scheme, which has been actually experimentally shown to be working. But before that, I discuss shortly the validity of the Franck-Condon approximation. Maybe I skip that. Then I go to this control scheme, which I called LOFRAS, or my collaborators, which is a tool for generating wave packets in the neutral ground state. Then I will speak shortly, maybe, about bond-softening-enhanced ionization, but probably I will have to skip that. And then I will go to recent results on orientational dependence of molecular ionization. And this will be partly based on the extension to larger molecules, which we just succeeded to have single active electron approximation applied for in principle, or applicable. The approach is applicable in principle to any possible molecule you can think of. So the apparatus is already there. We just have to apply it and to gradually increase the number of symmetry groups in the code. Okay, so I just as a reminder, because we have heard this so often, but this is of course the basic thing, and I will just continue where Andre had already made his important remark, that in this three-step model for imaging, the Corcomson three-step model, as it's often called, this is a later reference, of course, and here it's given in four steps, but okay. The idea is that the electron escapes through or over the electric field lowered Coulomb potential in the first step, then it runs out with the field driven by the field in a linear polarized field. Then the direction of the field, which is given here in yellow, will change, and the electron can come back. Of course, most of the electrons will just disappear. This is important to remind. And, but it can go back, and then it can do a lot of interesting things. Namely, it can scatter elastically, which would mean a self-electron diffraction experiment. Or it can scatter inelastically, which means it can do excitation, dissociation, double ionization, and all like that. Or it can recombine radiatively, which is exactly the idea of high harmonic generation in this picture. So if you want to analyze anything of these returning electron wave packet, which should contain, of course, the structural information, this is the idea, then, of course, the important part is this first step, yeah, this electron leaving. And this will be the focus of this talk. Yeah, of course, I cannot always separate that. So because if I solve the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, I also have the rescattered electrons in. But I will concentrate basically on the plethora of electrons, the majority of electrons. Yeah, and this is normally supposed to be the direct ones. Okay, just as a reminder, this is the high harmonic radiation, this recovery or imaging of the nitrogen HOMO, according to this paper. And we have heard about it, so I will skip it, and we will probably hear more on high harmonic imaging in other talks. Now, for me, more relevant is actually this experiment, also by the Corcomson group, by Meckel and others, published last year in Science. And the idea is that, okay, some electrons will tunnel directly out to the detector, and others may recollide and show thus diffraction. So in that case, you can say that the direct electrons, which normally you think are the ones which are the fast ones in the majority, but the low momentum, the slow momentum electrons, they should reveal, so to speak, the structure by this tunneling procedure. While the electron wave packet coming back and then diffracting, which is supposed to be normally the high energy electrons, which classically would not occur directly, so the outer part of the momentum distribution should reveal you the structure as an electron in an electron elastic electron diffraction experiment or an inelastic one. Now, of course, the problem will be to differentiate these processes. So from these pictures for oxygen and nitrogen, I mean the three-dimensionally resolved momentum distributions, there's the idea that you see differences in the structure due to the different homostructures of the nitrogen or the oxygen. So this is the idea of imaging directly with the electrons, yeah, or indirectly with the rescattered electrons. Okay. Yes?
Yes?
No, this is not non-classical. What I mean is that the energy distribution you would expect for the electrons should stop at 2 UP. We have discussed this already classically, but of course, quantum mechanically, this is not a sharp border.
It's not a sharp border.
Yeah? It's still returning, yeah. Okay, so what is the basis of imaging and manipulation schemes? You should have a simple and well-understood relation of experimental signal to the atomic or molecular structure. I mean, this is a basic thing you learn. What is a good imaging tool? Yeah, you should have this situation. So optimally, you have a factorization in the interaction times a structural factor. X-ray crystallography is a prime example for that. Because you go to a high energy photons or electrons in electron diffraction, with the idea that then you can use simplified description like first Born or plane wave first Born models.
By molecular structure, you mean initial molecular structure that you have before instance.
I want to be here completely open. Whatever you like. Yeah. If you want to have structure in general, if you want to get any information on the structure, yeah, from some experiment, you would like to have this ideal situation. Yeah, this can be also a time-resolved structural change, so dynamics. That's yeah. The key point is, however, to have this relation, a clear relation between the signal, the experimental signal, and whatever system or change of the system or whatever you want at any instant of time, if you have time-resolved, or just the structure if it's not time-resolved. So required would be a full understanding of atomic and molecular behavior in ultra-short pulses, so the shape of the electron wave pack at emission, tunneling out in this picture, and recollision. Yeah? Okay. So the problem is, however, that only simplified models exist for atoms and molecules in strong laser fields. So it is rather unclear what is their range of applicability, how accurate are their qualitative and especially quantitative predictions. Maybe they are not important quantitatively, but this has to be decided. And the validity for many electron, so to speak, real molecules, being beyond H2, my most favorite one. Yeah, but of course, I understand that people believe that there are more molecules in the universe than H2, although H2 is rather abundant, at least, in total. Okay, so qualitative strong field models, just for giving a quick introduction, is of course that you know that there are these different pictures which we have already been discussing. So you have these so-called multiphoton pictures where you say, okay, you can go from the ground state, either of course directly to the ionization, or you can do it via an intermediate state resonantly, then you have resonance enhanced multiphoton ionization Rampe peaks. Or you have a non-resonant, a multiphoton absorption process in this picture, multiphoton ionization. And if you absorb more photons in the continuum formally than you need, of course this is very misleading to speak here of the photon absorption, and people had in the beginning even made a lot of fuss about this impossibility of having ATI peaks, which is however rather clear that it should occur. Then you speak about above threshold ionization. So what you expect here is in the electron spectra, in the energy resolved electron spectra, that you have equidistant peaks, the ATI peaks. Now, this is a multiphoton regime. The other regime which we have been discussing before, I mean, as I said, it's of course a rather arbitrary cut is a quasi-static regime, where you speak about tunnel ionization because the Coulomb field distorts your the electric field distorts your Coulomb potential, or even if the distortion is sufficiently large, the electron can even escape over the barrier. Now, so this is just the simple pictures. And if you would now just, where would you expect these pictures to apply? Then you can make a sketch where this is the field strength now scaled by the square root of 2 times the binding energy or ionization energy of the system. And this is the photon energy divided by the binding energy. And then you should have, so to speak, the number of photons which you need to go into the, to ionize the system will be, of course, inverse to this scale. And then you would say, okay, there's this Kaldish parameter, the adiabaticity parameter, or whatever you want to call it, which separates somehow the quasi-static regime, which should live somewhere in this regime, and the multiphoton regime, which should be somewhere here. Now, the multiphoton regime, you can even further separate or split into the true non-resonant, non-perturbative multiphoton regime, and the one where lowest order perturbation theory should be valid. Yeah, so there's a regime of low intensities, low field strength, and high photon frequencies where lowest order perturbation theory, or in the one photon case, simply Fermi's golden rule should be applicable. The quasi-static regime, as I said, should be separated. This is a classical transition from tunneling to over the barrier. Yeah, I mean, this for the hydrogen type Coulomb system. Now, of course, the question is, do you recognize any of these in physics? I mean, these are nice pictures saying, okay, once you treat your laser field as a slowly varying electric field, in the other case, you treat it, as you know, from one photon, you go to two photon, and so on, I mean, perturbatively. So does it really occur? Yeah, or is it just nonsense and imagination? Yes?
The above threshold ionization. Where would you put that?
It would be occurring everywhere except in this regime. Okay. Because if the intensity is not sufficiently high, you should, I mean, if lowest order perturbation theory is valid, you will only see a single peak. Yeah? Because this is the lowest order of perturbation theory giving you just this peak. Yeah? And if you go higher in intensity, you see ATI in the all over outside this regime, you should see it.
The way that you sketched the ATI pictures was as a multiphoton process.
Yes, because this is so, seems so nice.
But depending on this parameter.
You would expect that actually, and this will is exactly what I try to speak about here, that it's actually in some way, in this high intensity regime, the ATI structure should die out. Because you should have, in principle, tunneling ionization, for example. And this is exactly so there. You would expect mainly the ATI peaks to be here. But the question is, of course, where do they stop, as you correctly ask. And then this is now hydrogen atom calculation, TDSE calculations, three-dimensional hydrogen atom, for different parameters. So it's all Gaussian pulses. So it's 10 femtosecond full width half maximum. And this is 400 nanometer, 800 nanometer, 1,600 nanometer. And now black and red are different intensities. It's probably too small to read. The black one is 2 times 10 to the 13, and the red one is 5 times higher, 10 to the 14. So now what you see here is in the low or short wavelengths regime, you see in the for the low intensity, as you would expect, a nice ATI structure. I mean, peaks separated by the photon energy. Yeah. And what you also see, this is a highly logarithmic scale from 10 to the 0, I mean, from 1 to 10 to the minus 16. So you see the first peak is dominating dramatically. And this is exactly the idea of lowest order perturbation theory. Yeah? All the other peaks may be there, but for quantitative analysis, they don't. Yeah? If you're not having a very good resolution, of course, then you will see them. So they are there, but they may be negligible for practical purposes. Now, if you increase the intensity, you see, again, still a rather good ITI shape, but you see already something happening to it. There is substructure occurring. And also, you see it's not so regularly going down, but also here, you saw there is some kind of a leveling out, which is called plateau, yeah, which you see some here. But of course, one has to be also careful that numerics is really converged. Now, if you go to longer wavelengths, you should go more into the quasi-static picture. And what you see is now you still have, for the low intensities, as you would expect, but by far not as pronounced, ATI peaks. And if you increase the intensity, okay, there are still ATI peaks, but you see now the problem that there are many interferences, and the structures of the ATI peaks are not at all well resolved. Yeah, so in the language of strong field approximation, which we have been discussing, there are different trajectories which interfere and give you these type of pictures. And of course, there's also rescattering and so on. So finally, if you go to even longer wavelengths, you start to see here very nicely that the ATI peaks are not really dominating. You know, there are some resemblance of that. But the key point is that you see more the exponential decay as you would expect from a tunneling picture. If you go to high intensities, okay, the decay gets, the steepness gets, or the slope gets smaller, and you get more substructure due to interferences, but still you have this overall, more this exponential decay behavior than this ATI spectra. So this is somehow why people believe in these pictures. Yeah, there is some truth in that, in the sense of that it's a nice picture to explain these type of behavior. There may be all complications from the pure theoretical point of view that, I mean, you have neither this or that. But in principle, there are regimes where you see what you would expect from these simple pictures. And this is, of course, what the physicist normally, from the pragmatic point of view, accepts as a valid model. OK. Yes, of course.
Behind that, I saw that the disappearance of peaks mm-hmm. could be related to the fact that for longer wavelengths, you might have good ionization only at one period of the laser field, because you bring ionization down and you might not be ionizing from different periods, and that's why the peak structure will not build up. So that would be another reason for
yes.
behavior.
You're right, yeah, of course. So of course, if you consider the pulse and there's a shape like this, and then you have the intensity maximum somewhere, then you should expect, of course, that, I mean, as Olga says, that of course, more and more for the not so high intensities, you should see most of the ionization happening close to the maximum of the field, and therefore, as you said, there will be less interferences from that point of view.
Also, when you increase the wavelengths, you have less periods in the pulse.
But this is exactly the key point. This is the key point that you have to be careful here, that the 1,600 nanometers and the same full width half maximum, you're in trouble. You can extend the full width half maximum, get a similar picture in principle. But then the problem is that then the people argue about why have you a different. So, I mean, you can either fix the number of cycles or not, but there's always a but. Yeah?
But the comparison is not satisfying because here you have only two cycles.
Yes. But as I said,
and there, there are no photons. I think it's something very.
I will come to this problem of the length exactly in the next.
Okay.
I just want to say that here, to remind those people who are not familiar in the field, what it really means in this photon picture, that 400 nanometers for hydrogen atom means you need at least 5 photons. And for 1,600 nanometers, you need 18 photons from the classical counting of photons picture. Yeah. So you see already that there's a problem. But as I said, I can show you pictures which look very similar if you prolong the pulse. Yeah. So it's not just this disappearance. But of course, you are absolutely right. It's an important point to consider the pulse, which is not considered in this simple picture. So if you consider, for example, the pulse shape for a short pulse, yeah, like the one 10 femtosecond full width half maximum which we saw before, then you see that depending on whether you put the pulse in different ways, and there comes also, of course, Olga's argument and so on, yeah, you see that, of course, the ATI spectra for the same other parameters change drastically, and they look like here you have a multiphoton and here you have more a quasi-static picture. Yeah? So it is really important that it's not sufficient for short pulses, what we are normally now speaking of, to forget about the pulse shape completely. You have to be really careful that some of these simple pictures, which are normally only related to the Kalish parameter, which does not consider any pulse shape, can be misleading. Yeah, so one has to be careful. Now, another thing with the ultra-short pulses is, of course, a question of the rate. Yeah, do you achieve a rate? Is the pulse long enough to give you a rate? And here, what you see is different curves for Gaussian pulses with 650 nanometers on this side, it's 800 nanometers on this side. And now the pulse length is, or the full width half maximum, is changed from 2.5 to 20 femtoseconds. So in principle, if you take the ratios, which are shown in the inset, between 5 to 2.5, 10 to 5, 20 to 10, if you have a rate, simply speaking, you should expect a ratio of 2 constant. What you see now is that, of course, it converges somehow around the 2, but it depends very much, especially on the intensity. This is a peak intensity scale from 10 to the 13, so to speak, to 10 to the 14. And you see that the convergence to this rate is intensity dependent. So you cannot just assume, because you have a long pulse, it is a rate. You have to be careful also with intensity. Yeah, this together plays a role. And if you consider 650 to 800 nanometers, the same thing otherwise, you see that the structures of this ratio is completely wavelength dependent on top of it. So just to speak, OK, I have a rate because I have a five-cycle pulse or whatever, is not sufficient. Yeah, it depends on intensity and on the wavelengths also. Of course, the wavelength is partly included, I agree to this, in the number of cycles, but it's not sufficient to explain this different difference in structure. Yeah? And of course, the most interesting thing, but of course it's from the quantum mechanical point of view not amazing, is that you can have the situation that the ratio is even below 1, yeah, so that a shorter pulse can give you more ionization than a longer pulse. Yeah, it's just if you hit the system quickly enough, yeah, then it will be responding differently. I mean, we had this also in your talk, of course, on the sudden approximation. Now, for the imaging, normally people assume that they are in the so-called quasi-static regime. So this is why I focus here on that. Now, the idea is that the atomic and molecular response to the intense laser field is similar to the response to a slowly varying electric DC field with strength F. So you get your ionization rate in the AC laser field, I mean the dynamic electric field of the laser, ignoring the magnetic component in this non-relativistic treatment, or dipole treatment, actually, finally. You integrate over, or average over a period of the electric ionization or electric field, DC field ionization rate, which now has a time-dependent field strength. So this should be valid low frequency, high intensity, as I said before. And as I said, it's the preferred regime for imaging schemes, because you expect that here your simple Korkum's model will work. Now, and you have these ionization peaks at the field maxima, which gives you this sub-laser cycle time resolution. This is, of course, part of the time resolution in these imaging concepts. Now, the problem is that actually, for any DC ab initio rate beyond hydrogen atom, it's non-trivial. Yeah? To my knowledge, there exists one for H2+, by Plummer and McCain. And there exists MY1 for H2 in a full correlated three-dimensional treatment, which has never been repeated by anyone else, so maybe it's complete garbage. But yeah, it stands still there alone, to my knowledge. Not to speak of any system like nitrogen, oxygen, or whatever. Yeah, of course, there are some ways to try to do this, and I think they are now on the way. Still, whether they can be done fully is not so trivial. I just want to say that even the quasi-static approximation alone is often not sufficient to give you a simple description of the ionization. That's the key message. So what people normally do is they use additional approximations. And this is why I emphasize that this tunneling is not quasi-static. And tunneling is also not, and tunneling and over the barrier is also not quasi-static. Yeah? You have to be careful. Quasi-static for me is really the full DC ab initio rate, the full correct treatment. Yeah? And then comes additional approximations, like saying, OK, the DC rate can be approximated by some tunneling rate. And this tunneling rate you can get from some models, like the Landau formula for the static rate. We have already heard about it. Yeah? The key point being that it's depending on this for the hydrogen atom. You can only hear the field strength in the exponent. It has been, or it is an extended version of it, is the PPT, Perelomov-Popov-Terentov. Approximation, which is based on Landau but extended to non-hydrogenic atoms. And then, of course, the IP occurs here explicitly. And then there's, for the experimentalists, the most popular ones, because I don't know, Stirling saves them from calculating factorial. I always try to say the German word, which is meaning something completely different. So this is why, yeah, factorial. Thank you. Yeah, to avoid to calculate the factorial. So basically, for the hydrogen atom, it's just a difference of the constant factor 1.18 in between. Yeah, so it's a way how you calculate things. So the ADK model, as I said, is very popular for the experimentalists, and yeah, will be also used here from therefore as a reference.
So what's W? Gamma is the rate.
Oh, I probably mixed. I've forgotten here to change this to gamma. Sorry. Good. Somebody's not sleeping. Even more than one. Okay. Yeah, it's true. This should be a gamma. This should be this one. Sorry. I had a mixed notation, then I tried to go everywhere to gamma, and of course.
And the 1.18 is just an empirical, or it comes out
from
Stirling?
It comes from the it comes out from their way of treating the Coulomb problem, so to speak. Yeah.
That's commonly called the ground state.
Yeah, of course. Sorry. Yeah, for a hydrogen atom, I mean ground state. Yes.
There is
exactly.
N and M dependent prefactor.
So the key point is that they use your effective quantum numbers, and here's a different way to get this effective non-hydrogenic system. But due to this definition, you get differences to the even in the hydrogen atom, which are a constant. Okay, now actually these models are not too bad, and I just of course make a small commercial here that we have recently with the Max Born people, Uli Eichmann and others, we have compared the population of bound states in helium created by a strong laser field, once calculated with a tunneling or ADK type of model, including some Monte Carlo simulation or classical trajectory calculation of the electron going out, the Monte Carlo simulation of different initial trajectories, and then analyzing, so to speak, in which the energy bins, in which quantum state the electron remains, because it tries to tunnel. But then the tunnel closes before it is out, or it cannot reach out because it doesn't have enough energy, so to speak, in this classical picture. Now, this seems to be a very wild, simple picture, and of course, I was not very happy about it. But I have to admit that doing a full two-electron calculation is not too far away from what they get in their simple simulation. So if you have the simple tunneling with recapture model, this is the red dots, the N distribution, and the full ab initio results in a single electron model, an effective one, which is the squares, it looks very convincing. Now, if you do a full two electron calculation, at least there is something. You see the blue triangles do not look that perfectly agreeing, but this is, of course, a simple one electron model, but the agreement is still rather convincing, and the same is actually true for the L distribution, which we haven't shown in this recent paper. Yeah. So I just want to say that, I mean, we call this frustrated tunneling ionization because the electrons are not managing to come over into the continuum. But it shows that, I mean, sometimes these simple models work surprisingly well even for differential quantities. Maybe pure coincidence, but...
But I want to mm-hmm. make sure that I understand how the simple calculation was done.
Yes.
I think my recollection is mm-hmm. that they place the electron on the outside of the barrier.
Yes, because you have
the probability given by tunneling.
Yes, exactly.
So at this point, formally, the mm-hmm. electron is free.
Yes, but the
then they run the trajectory.
Exactly.
And the presence of the ionic mm-hmm. core recaptures.
Yes, exactly.
The electron.
I probably didn't describe it well enough. Evidently, if you have to ask it this way, yes.
Okay. No, because the way you describe it is that the barrier closes
okay.
during mm. tunneling.
Okay.
But really, it is not. Right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay.
It's. By hand, yeah. And then I see what happens.
Yes.
After.
The question is how you define the tunneling in the classical to the quantum mechanical analog somehow.
Tunneling in classical mechanics you define
exactly.
You take collector by
it, put it there where you want. Exactly.
On the other side.
I know. But I didn't want to dwell too much into this discussion here because I don't want to promote this model too much.
It works.
Yes, but I want just to give it as an example that these simple models can work, but let me please, yes?
These states are around M equals, say, 9, 10.
Mm-hmm. So below some 8 or so, yeah, depending.
Mm-hmm. Are below the barrier when you think it's maximum, or they are still below?
Oh, way above.
Way above.
Way above.
Okay.
Yes. It's a rather high intensity.
So they don't tend.
No, you end up. No, you start in the ground state.
Yes.
You formally tunnel.
Ah, okay.
It's just the analysis. Finally, you project onto the with the energy bin. You say, okay, if it's remaining on the below the continuum, and in this energy bin, it is in this state.
Then why you can't have plainly multiphoton excitation to these states?
Of course you can. No. I mean, I just
on that, but sorry, continue.
I mean, my comment is the following, which we try to emphasize in this paper. We don't want to say that we can exclude, because of this agreement, any multiphoton explanation of the same distribution.
That can happen.
Very fine. Yeah. The point is simply that what we want to say is that if you do this simple model, you get astonishing agreement.
But during the rise of the pulse, you can populate these states.
As I said, I don't want to say that a multiphoton picture wouldn't work. I want to avoid, because for me, there is no, it's just pictures, which, as I tried to say in the beginning, sometimes work surprisingly well.
Okay.
Yeah?
Maybe I can add a comment. I don't know if we're taking too long, but I still.
Probably,
yeah. I think that what this paper is saying is that there is an alternative perspective on multiphoton excitation viewed on the sub-cycle timescale. So you look at the same process, but not over many, many periods in the photon picture and energy domain, but on the sub-cycle timescale. And so tunneling and multiphoton are just different ways of seeing the same thing, either sub-cycle in space or over many cycles in energy.
I mean, you will see that I'm basically critical about these things. The point is just that I think it's still, I mean, it's fair to compare. Yeah, I don't want to criticize something just because I don't like it for some principal reasons. I just want to see how good does it behave. Sorry. I wouldn't like to go now too much into this tunneling multiphoton debate. Yes.
Can I think of this as you have within the tunneling picture, you tilt, but then you close before the some gets out, but this is the stuff that's left. You close the window, now your pulse is over, so you're back in the ordinary healing.
We don't necessarily resolve these pictures, because we just make the simulation.
But this is essentially this distribution is creating a wave packet, which is now trapped.
In the atom. Yes, exactly. I mean, the key point for the experimentalists, first of all, was that they could measure excited states, and seemingly people normally forget about it. And what this, although theorists like me emphasize since years, that there is a lot of bound state excitation. But since nobody looks at it, it's supposed to be non-interesting. Yeah? And now this was a motivation here. And then to explain it.
Anyway, when you, sorry. Just,
yes.
Just,
I was as bad as you before.
When you solve the time-dependent Schrödinger equation
it's helium here.
Pulse, you find always a lot of population.
This is what I said. This is exactly what I just said.
The Schrödinger equation is that it doesn't tell you when, by which mechanism.
Exactly.
These electrons were.
Exactly. The nice thing, they are there,
and they are.
Of course, this is what I said. I mean, in every theoretical calculation, you get them, plenty of them. Sometimes they are overwhelming. Yeah, but the experimentalists normally ignore it. This was my statement. Yeah, because there are not too many experimentalists here. Okay, so. Now, if you go to now to a molecule, what would you expect in this simple picture to happen? Now, the idea is that originally, for surprising, maybe not surprising reasons, because most of the strong field people were coming from the atomic physics area, the idea was, okay, if you look at the ionization rate in the ADK model, like in all these tunneling models, you get this dependence on the field strength and the binding energy or ionization potential of your system. So a natural choice is to assume that this is a dominant part because there's some prefactor, but this, okay, this will be details compared to this exponential term. And therefore, you should have identical ionization rates for atoms and molecules with identical binding energy. This was somehow the belief when I started in this field, to my initial surprise, because for me, a molecule was always not an atom, but okay. Now, what molecular effects would you expect? Of course, you have vibration. So there's vibrational excitation and dissociation. Then the other point is, of course, that your electron density varies with nuclear geometry. If you have vibration, of course, you know, in the von Oppenheimer picture, it's clear the electrons will immediately or adiabatically be adapted or immediately adapting to the new geometry. So you will have a new electron density. The other effect is, of course, rotation. So you have rotation and excitation, yeah, like you can even have dissociation, optical centrifuge. Or the electron density is also anisotropic. So you should have an orientational dependence once you have a different initial state than the isotropic one. Now I will go only on the second points, yeah, on the electronic effect due to vibration or rotation. Yeah, so the electron density depends on nuclear geometry, and later on it's anisotropic, if I find the time. So now, when I started, my initial idea was that this is a strange idea, that this would be the same for atoms and molecules. And my initial moment was that I would, in the von Oppenheimer spirit, which everyone adopted according to what the people were saying, I would assume that what you should do really is you should extend the ADK model for a molecule by replacing the ionization potential with something non-experimentally measurable, but the vertical binding energy difference between the neutral and the ion. Now, if you do this, you can immediately, for diatomic systems, consider three generic cases. Yeah, very simple. So you can consider a case like nitrogen. I mean, nitrogen is a good example. Of course, it's not perfect. So this is a perfect model, A2 plus, where the equilibrium distance of A2 plus and also the shape of the potential curve is the same than for A2, which for nitrogen, if you look up Hertzberg, is quite well fulfilled. And as a consequence, of course, this difference is a constant. And you really get, like in an atomic model, you get the same dependence on the internuclear separation of the ionization rate, yeah, as you would expect in an atomic case. However, if you have a case like hydrogen molecule, a bonding HOMO in the chemistry's language, then you would, of course, remove one bonding electron, which means that your bond length will stretch to the ion. And as a consequence, this difference will not be constant. And as a consequence, because you have an exponential dependence on this binding energy, you should see on a logarithmic scale, 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 11 in this model case, you should see a strong variation of the molecular ionization rate in this ADK model as a function of the internuclear separation. The same occurs for oxygen, just with the opposite thing. You remove an antibonding electron, and therefore you shorten the bond, and you get the opposite effect, but you get the same, I mean, strong dependence. Okay, I will therefore maybe skip the Frank-Hontan for time reasons, and just say that as a consequence of this, I remarked in the previous paper, just as a side remark, of course, Frank-Hontan will not be applicable for H2, yeah, for a case like H2 or oxygen. And the key point was that I confirmed this then by a full ab initio calculation of the DC ionization rate, as I said before, as a function of R, and then you see really that it behaves in this regime around the equilibrium internuclear distance, really like I expected from the simple extended ADK model. Now it's quantitatively agreeing, which is very depressing if you do a full complex scale CI with explicitly correlated wave functions. And the outcome is that it matches perfectly the ADK model. This is again, of course, where people come in and say, you know, ADK is wrong, is correct. We knew this all the time. Yeah, most of the experimentalists will claim this. So, but there is some nice effects which show that there's more than just ADK. Now, the nice thing was that this was experimentally confirmed. I will not go here into details because, as I said, so the comparison with a simple model even is quite well of the vibrational distribution H2+ found experimentally on this side and predicted theoretically with this very simple model.
Sorry, I have a question just to understand. So the Falconian principle has three aspects. One is bicondal, that is that the transition dipole operator is a constant. That's one ingredient.
And this is exactly what I just claimed is not fulfilled.
Okay, that I would take.
Yeah, but this, of course, people did not realize necessarily. That's the point.
I would like to say, not finished yet. So
yes?
There are two more points. One is this
vertical transition
of the atom, of the nuclei positions
and momentum. Yes.
And I must say, by all my own experience, this is usually fulfilled within very small deviations.
Especially in a short pulse, you can argue that the vertical transition argument is probably a very good argument.
Okay, I just wanted to make this confirmation. Thank you.
Now, the key point of course, this was a very simple model, and this was not my idea to stay with us, is to do the full TDSE solution for the electronic part of two electrons in all dimensions. Now, initially in this paper, we managed for the period orientation. I will later, shortly say that we are also in the perpendicular orientation. So we have really the full dimensional solution. Yeah? And this is just a technical sketch of what we are doing. We do use this typical semi-classical approximation with a classical electromagnetic field, non-relativistic, dipole approximation, etc. And we do a time-dependent CI, expanding the wave function, the time-dependent wave function in field-free states. Now, the key point is that we use prolate spherical coordinates and we expand the orbitals in B-splines. So this gives us a finite box and a way to handle the continuum. Yeah? So that's the crucial point. I mean, the time-dependent CI is conceptual trivial. Yeah? And you just need energies and dipole moments and you can do a CI. I mean, time-dependent CI, there's no deal. Yeah? The key point is to treat the continuum properly. Yeah? This is where our work goes in, not in the formulation of the time-dependent CI. That's, as I said, it's textbook, actually. If you just plug in the CI wave function in the standard textbook time-dependent treatment, you get these coupled differential equations for your coefficients. So it should be exact for the two electrons within these all these approximations, especially the fixed nuclei in the moment. And of course, with this, we could now verify this R dependence. This is the full TDSE calculation for parallel orientation. This is the ADK result. And blue is the ADK result just multiplied by a constant factor 25. Yeah, and if you go to different intensities, this was a graph I just showed you. This is 3 times 10 to the 13. This is 10 to the 14. You see that the agreement gets better and better. And here, even you don't have to scale. But I stop here because going further means ADK happily moves above the TDSE solution, which is understandable because it's over barrier and so on. But this is not the point here. The key point is that this R dependence you really find in the full TDSE calculation. So now coming to control, can you use this effect? And we propose that it's possible to use it using the so-called Lochfraß phenomenon. This is a German word for eating a hole by an animal. So more violent. In English, you don't have a word for animals eating. They eat this also. Yeah. So and biting a hole was already taken. So we took this German word and we managed to get it through. Yeah. So it's in PRL published. And okay. So the idea is rather simple. You have a pronounced R-dependent ionization yield. Your fast ionization process, vertical, will deplete the large R component of the wave function in the case of H2 primarily. If you do this quick enough, yeah, you will have a coherent vibrational wave packet. And now comes the important point, not only in the H2 plus state, which is known for a long time, but also due to this R dependence in the neutral ground state. Yeah, so you create a neutral or a vibrational wave packet in the neutral non-ionized ground state. Now, this is a purely quantum mechanical effect, why it was very difficult to convince both experimentalists and referees from it, because it's a kind, you could call it Schrödinger cat state of the ionized and the neutral molecule. Yeah. So as long as you don't measure that it's ionized, yeah, you have this superposition state, and only this superposition state explains you that you have a wave packet. It's rather clear from the quantum mechanical point of view, but if you visualize it in your mind, of course, you get to this quantum mechanical trouble, yeah, that it's difficult to imagine that the far away electron, yeah, knows whether it is ionized or not only when it is measured. Yeah, so a standard problem. So the key point for the from the practical point of view is that it's an absolutely non-resonant process. So it's not like stimulated Raman or so. I think it's stimulated Raman. So it's very robust because of it, because you have no resonances coming into play. You don't have to fulfill any resonant conditions. And it's quite independent on the exact pulse shape, wavelengths, phase of the laser, etc. So we have checked this numerically. So it's a highly nonlinear process, which means that a second propulse should detect the tide-independent ionization signal, because now you have created in your neutral ground state, you have created a wave packet moving back and forth. And now, of course, if you take a second pulse, you will ionize preferentially if the wave packet is in the outer side. Yeah, and therefore you have an enhancement of this nonlinear effect, this R dependence twice. In the case of H2 or D2, this should result actually in the fastest vibrational motion observed so far, because it's even faster than in H2 plus due to the different potential curve. You create an extremely long-lived wave packet, because the vibration de-excitation requires two photon transitions in a homonuclear system, and you create a wave packet V0, V1, basically, as the calculation shows. So it's a kind of molecular clock or pendulum. And for other molecular systems, I want to emphasize that, of course, if whenever you have a clear nuclear geometry dependence of the difference of the potential or hyperpotential surfaces of the neutron or the ion, you should have this effect, which means you should also be able for larger molecules to excite coupled vibrational modes and to make their real-time observation in principle possible.
Can I ask a question?
Yes?
So in the early 90s, Ronnie Kosloff and others, they studied a process called, which they called quantum hole burning.
Yeah, this is in this Raman. Exactly, it's related, but the key difference beside this paper, the key difference is the non-resonant part.
Okay. Yeah, that was resonant.
Exactly, yeah? So almost resonant, I mean, it's in the Raman process. And this is exactly the key point which makes this so stable. Yeah, but we were aware of this work. It's cited there. So now this is the internuclear separation, the expectation value as a function of time in a short 8 femtosecond laser pulse of 800 nanometers, 6 times 10 to the 14. And you see how R decreases because you eat more away from the larger R wave function component. And then you start a steady oscillation, which actually occurs to be rather, as I said, insensitive to practically everything, as long as you are in this regime, yeah, of ionization. And this is then a simulation of the pump probe experiment. The ionization yield as a function of the delay time between 2 8 or 12 femtosecond laser pulses. You see also the pulse length, yeah, has no influence on the steady oscillation you get. And finally, it was really observed experimentally in the group of Joachim Ulrich. It appeared finally back-to-back because we were not able to fight successfully with the referees as long as the experiment was not there, because they were just refusing the possibility of this effect or its visibility or its experimental relevance and whatever. So even with the experiment, it was a tough fight. So finally, okay, we got this, or the experimentalists get this oscillation of the ion, the undissociated ion, and also the dissociation yield. Actually, we can even explain why they are out of phase with a simple model, so I will not go here into it. But the key point is that, of course, you have a control here because they are out of phase between preferentially non-dissociative or dissociative ionization, yeah, if you want to have some control. Now, I will skip this. although it's a nice thing, that one can even determine the mechanism by the phase, by the absolute phase. But I just want to mention that this effect was now also seen in iodine, where it's of course much easier because the timescales are more favorable for longer pulses by Gibson and Fang. And there's another paper where they show that the cooling somehow, that I mean, having a higher thermal incoherent state, I mean, a higher temperature in the beginning gives you more coherence in your final result. That means that increasing incoherence in your initial state, with this effect, you create more coherence in your wave packet. And the reason is this tremendous insensitivity of the effect on phase, etc., and how you do the excitation. And as a consequence, the same procedure happens for all the excited vibration states independently. They are incoherent. But they are forced into the laser's rhythm by the laser somehow, but it's not the laser rhythm, that's the key part. It's an intrinsic scale of the oscillation of the B equals 0 and B equals 1 into which they end up. And it happens preferentially, of course, for those states, why it's a gain to go up, is of course simply because if you would start with a pure state, you would also have a gain. Simply because the overlap, I mean, this wave function probes more of the asymmetry of the ionization than the ground state. Yeah? But it's an interesting effect, and as I already told you, maybe one could consider it really from the standpoint of view of cooling. Yeah? There are some limitations, as you pointed out, but I think still it's worthwhile to think about it. Now, beyond quasi-static, there is a KFR or SFA approximation. I have, of course, no time to go into the details. I just want to write it here down, that there is more than ADK or tunneling. And the idea is that, in principle, you can write it, of course, as a time-dependent S-matrix expansion. And formally, you can write the full exact thing, yeah, but in the post or prior forms, and with T2 going to infinity or plus minus infinity. And this is already, I mean, the concept is written by Kaldish in the seminal paper in 65. And the key concept is if you just now take this amplitude and by hand or by an S-matrix expansion, like a Born series, you say, okay, you ignore the influence of the remaining ion on the ionized electron in the final state. You describe the electron by Volkov wave function, the free electron in a laser field. Then you can get, so to speak, a solvable problem, more or less. I mean, it's not so trivial as it looks on the paper if you do it really in practice, but it's doable. Yeah. The problem is, of course, that it's derived for short-range potentials, so what about Coulomb corrections? Now, when we just wanted to compare to S-matrix calculation of strong field results, we found out that you are immediately overwhelmed by different formulations and different discussions. So Kaldish used the length gauge and the reverse time S-matrix, Faisal, the velocity gauge, the direct time S-matrix, Howard Rice, the velocity gauge, reverse time S-matrix. Of course, everyone claiming that, I mean, Kaldish, I don't know, but Faisal and Rice claiming that theirs is the most appropriate. And of course, this is very confusing because if you then do some additional approximations, which you normally have to do, then it gets very difficult to understand what is really meant. Now, but this, for this reason, some people call this KFR, although it's, of course, three different formulations of the same concept. Now, Wilhelm Becker even proposes to address the initial state, which makes things even more complicated. And then we were even completely startled by some papers by these people, which said that they can do an exact Kaldish theory by avoiding the settle point approximation, use the residual theorem instead, and show that this makes a big difference for everything beyond hydrogen 1s. Where it's just a factor of 4, which is still a factor of 4. But of course, we were startled. I mean, nobody else of this group were responding to that. Yeah. So what should we believe now? What should we compare to? Should we compare to the, according to them, wrong results here, or what? So yeah, we just showed finally mathematically that, unfortunately, this exact Kaldish theory is wrong because they forgot an important aspect of it. So they use the textbook Cauchy integration, which normally always tells you that you take around your pole some infinite contour, which goes to zero everywhere. Yeah, And in textbook examples, it always works like this. But here, unfortunately, we could show it doesn't work. There's always a divergency you cannot avoid. And therefore, this part you cannot ignore. It can be even larger than the pole contributions. OK, I will skip this and go to the molecular strong field models. Now, of course, a natural extension of the ADK model beyond the one I called now extended ADK with the R-dependent binding energy is the so-called MOADK by Tong and others, which adopts a single active electron approximation and projects the long-range behavior of the molecular orbital, typically the HOMO, but it's not restricted to that, to a hydrogen-like wave function and uses then the ADK for hydrogen. Of course, it should be restricted to the tunneling regime. They will confirm this immediately when you ask them, but this doesn't mean that they only use it in this regime, like the experimentalists also. I mean, they compare wherever they have something first to ADK, and if it matches, it matches. Yeah? Now, the other approach, natural extensions, of course, on the SFA, the molecular SFA. And again, the single active electron approximation is adopted. And then the key idea was to express the SFA amplitude of the HOMO or others in terms of linear combinations of atomic orbitals, and then use either the velocity gauge. Actually, it's funny. Normally, you find this citation, but here everything is in and done for benzene already. Yeah, and even the interferences are discussed. But I'm almost, except of the authors of this paper, I never find this paper cited in this context as a source for the velocity gauge molecular SFA. Now, or you can use the length gauge, Jensen and Madsen, or you can use the dressed length gauge, Milosevic. Again, you have some possibilities. Yeah, and of course, there. I mean, this is his initial dressing or half dressing and whatever. So there are even two variants of this in the same paper. So you can choose what you like, what is your personal preference. Sorry? Exactly, yes, okay. Your personal preference. Okay, now what about larger molecules? So what we wanted to do is, since all these models were based on the single active electron approximation, we wanted to make a standard, just to say, okay, if we adopt this, I don't know whether it's a good approximation or not, but just what would be coming out if we do this. So we merged together, with, especially with Piero de Clever, but we also get very important contribution from Alberto Castro from Hardy's group. Still or? Yeah.
Still.
Okay. So we solved the time-dependent Schrödinger equation within the single active electron approximation, which is, of course, a twisting of physics. But yeah, we can show see whether it works or not, at least for some things like H2. Now, the approach is described here, and where we also make a comparison for H2 and with all the MOADK and strong field approximation, length gauge, velocity gauge. So the idea is that we perform a standard DFT calculation. Then we use this to get project this on a multi-center B-spline basis. So this is a pre-convergence. This is the final convergence of the Cohn-Chelm equations. And then we freeze all but the HOMO or some any other orbital and solve the effective one electron TdSe using the Cohn-Chelm orbitals here. So important, it's not time-dependent DFT. Yeah, and the funny thing is, from our comparisons to the full calculation, it's turned out that these single active electron results are much better than time-dependent DFT or time-dependent Hartree-Fock, for H2 at least. Yeah, where also Andre has recently. We have this paper is on H2, but the method is, of course, now we have adopted for larger things.
And if you change functionally, you get completely different results, unfortunately.
We also do a CO2. Okay. So this is a validity check for H2. As I said, I don't want to, again, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying a single active electron approximation, because we have implemented it, is now the thing to use for everyone. Yeah, I don't know. I just want to know whether it works or not. Yeah? So please don't take me wrong here. So for us, the reference is a full two electron calculation for H2. Yeah? And now this is the CI result, the black curve. And on top of it, you see the DFT, or for H2, it's trivial to make a Hartree-Fock core of the ionization times 2 for the two equivalent electrons. And you see on this log scale, I mean, this is 10 orders of magnitude we are covering here. I mean, they are tremendously good. until about saturation, about 10% ionization, then of course you understand that this single active electron model where one is frozen, this doesn't make sense any longer. And finally, of course, you get an even with the factor two, of course, a too high rate. The funny thing is if you don't take the factor two, it fits quite nicely here. So there's a very short transition regime, which we don't know why. So, okay, we can compare it now to NOA decay. Just compare the TDSE, the red one, which is agreeing to the CI, the black one, quite well with a factor two, with MOA decay with the same functional, two equivalent, to recover the stupidity of the single active electron model. I mean, you have two electrons, and you treat one in the core of the other one frozen. Of course, there's no reason to select this one. With the same chance, you could select the other one.
They become distinguishable.
The key point is that if you have sufficient ionization, the potential seen by the others changes too much, yeah. And it's more like, yeah, exactly. But I wouldn't, this agreement here without the factor two, I would not overemphasize too much because it's in saturation regime, there can be other factors influencing that. But you see ADK with the same function as the purple one disagrees completely except in a very small intensity window where it is tunneling. Yeah, it's over barrier above and it's not really tunneling below. But the key point is there is a very small regime where MOA decay actually works. Yeah. Now this is the same with the different SFA models. Velocity gauge is here twice. Once with a kind of Coulomb correction factor we have derived, although again I would not say we believe this is a Coulomb factor. We just got it by merging or looking at it in the omega goes to zero limit of the velocity gauge SFA and merged it there to the tunneling result. And the velocity gauge with the Andreas Becker and co-workers correction. Now what you see here is that the TDSE, now the one with the single active electron model, compares quite well to the SFA. Actually, it compares very well with the SFA. The blue one with the Becker correction is slightly off. The funny thing is if you use a Hartree-Fock functional, our TDSE result is on top of each other, but then the Becker correction gives a perfect match and ours is shifted accordingly. I have no idea what for the reason. The only claim we can say is that the SFA is much more sensitive to your orbitals than the TDSE. Yeah, and your core description. That's the basic bottom line here. Length gauge, there's a problem of defining the correction factor. Otherwise, the shape is quite fine, but it's small. Now, the important point for understanding is that besides this nice agreement over many orders of magnitude, this correction factor is not small. It's two orders of magnitude, typically, in this regime here. Yeah? So, and it's the velocity gauge, like the length gauge, gives, without Coulomb correction, a too low result. Yeah? Now, you can immediately consider what it means if you do, if you claim that what you're doing is an S-matrix full expansion, a series expansion, and you cut off after the first term, which is normally in first born you do easily. But what does it mean here? You get something where the first term is two or three orders of magnitude smaller than the remainder. Okay? Yeah?
But the Coulomb correction is a one center, it's not two center, is it?
On top of it, you can debate about the sense or nonsense of this.
Correction, nobody's done it.
Exactly. No. Exactly. It's just, I mean, Andreas is completely, or was frankly, that what he actually was found empirically and only argued later on some physical grounds. Yeah? Of course, there's a big problem. I just want to say that, I mean, you have an order of magnitude mismatch, which people tend to forget because of these nice agreements. Yeah? And because experiments are typically not measuring absolute. So now you can do the same. This is a repetitive. This is the same for nitrogen, which we can now do with our calculation, of course, also. And you see now that, again, the SFA is not too bad. MOA decay is a disaster. Yeah? But still the one which experimenters will tell you that they can calibrate their experiment, the intensity with that, yeah, for funny reasons. Even in the common paper on helium, I could not refuse them to do this. And even to argue that, oh, the TDSE result is quite good agreeing if we shift it by the, in the intensity. And I said, yeah, you should shift the 80K. No, no, no. But yeah, so OK. Now, we can now speak about the anisotropy shortly, the second effect, where we have rather new results. Now, again, if you consider this, of course, this is the electron spectra. But now you can also consider, of course, that there should be information. I mean, Andre has discussed it with H2+. Of the symmetry of your initial orbit state seen in the full electron spectrum, just integrated over the whole electron energy spectrum. Now, the question is, does it work? And the other problem is, of course, that this was a reminder of this experiment. And if you look at this sketch, there's a funny problem in that. Namely, that there's also a problem because, I mean, here you see the nice thing, the direct electrons visualize the structure. And then there's a wave packet coming back for the diffraction. And if you look at the wave packet, it looks very nice because it's a plane wave almost. But here you said it's not a plane wave. So you have to fold, of course, whatever you do in your second step, in the recollision step, may it be harmonics, may it be rescattered electrons, you have to fold, of course, with the first step. Yeah. If the first thing is easy, okay, it may work. But otherwise, if you have a lot of structural information, you may have actually too much structural information in this. Yeah, and you have to know a way to unfold it properly. Now, this is what we did now for nitrogen. Should be submitted any day now. This is an experiment, Pavicic et al. From the Korkum group. The experimental resolution of the orientational dependence of the ionization yield integrated over energy for nitrogen experiment versus our TDSE theory. And this is the orientational dependence for different orbitals. So this is the HOMO minus 1 and HOMO minus 2 orbitals. And you see here, of course, they come rather close. They are not close, but still, of course, you at some point, this is, depends on the intensity. So you have to be very careful. It doesn't work all the time like this, but the separation can be easily with a different intensity go such that the HOMO minus 1 gets relevant. This is for oxygen. Yeah, oxygen has a pi g initial state, and you see the symmetry of it in the orientational dependence of ionization. And here, experiment and theory are in extremely good agreement, I would say.
You should show the MOADK, it's completely wrong.
Yes.
It's non-zero at zero.
Yes. But it's not strictly zero, but OK. Yeah, but you see this different curves. But the key point compared to nitrogen, and we had this argument already last week, is, of course, the separation of the HOMO minus 1 from the HOMO is different. And this makes it even cleaner. Yeah, probably also for the single active electron model. And then we have CO2, which is a chronicle case. And I don't want to go here into too many details, but you see already the HOMO minus 1 comes into play. Yeah, and things are not so easy. Now, the experiment finds a very narrow distribution, which none of the theories I know has reproduced so far. We get rather nice with the red one, but still, of course, it's not nice. We get a better one if we do some twist of physics. Which is this blue one, but I don't want to go into details here what this means. The key point is we can, of course, just to show you that our code is really general, we can also, we don't have to do linear molecules only. So this is water. So this is orientational dependence for the HOMO and for the HOMO minus 1 of water molecules. And you see here, the key point is that at certain angles or orientations, the HOMO minus 1 dominates. And this will, of course, influence your imaging. Of course, your imaging will still be dominated by this HOMO, but not everywhere. So you have to be very careful. Because if the HOMO is small, has a node, the HOMO minus 1 can be important.
Sorry, can you just help yes? me with the water molecule? So where is the oxygen and where are
the Very good question. So this is a sketch, the three-dimensional sketch. So this is a HOMO. Yeah, and you see this, the z-axis is the upwards axis, yeah, and the HOMO is along the y-axis. Yeah, and you see really that there is a match between, actually this is somehow not perfectly. It looks different in reality. It's not that perfectly looking like this one, actually. It's now a little bit due to the, I mean, just technically.
That's the lone pair, right?
That's the lone pair, right. Exactly. Yeah. But what you see is you should see its symmetry. Yeah. But as I said, if you look carefully, of course, you see a homomorphism 1, and you have to be very careful, especially with intensity. Because if you have other intensities, the homomorphism 1 can dominate in this regime dramatically, and you just see something completely different. This is shown here, the ratio of between in the y direction to the z direction of the homo to the homomorphism 1, and you see it's strongly intensity dependent. Now, finally, you can also consider, of course, phase effects. Yeah, absolute phase effects in a very short pulse in a water molecule, which has a dipole moment. So you see asymmetries as a function, as you would expect. Now, one can go back to the simplest question, to H2. Yeah, and what is now higher or easier to ionize, parallel or perpendicular orientation? At the equilibrium distance, not if you have enhanced ionization in H2+. So there are different proposals based on different models. And the key point why it's not easy to us to resolve this question, we have discussed this already, is even for fixed nuclei, you have to solve a 6+1 dimensional problem. Now, I don't think this is prohibitive, so we can do it, actually. So this is a full calculation for 800 nanometers, 1.4 internuclear separation for H2, both electrons in all dimensions. This is a total ionization yield parallel, red, to perpendicular, blue. And this is original with one laser peak, and this is after focal averaging. And now I noticed that, of course, I needed Adobe Professional to extract the PDF file, or at least I couldn't find a way to extract the PDF file of the experiment. I don't know whether you want to look at it. There is some picture, the figure 2 here. I just made the last move. And of course, the color printer, as usual, when you have the last minute idea, the color printer was blocked by some internal report. So the key point is that there is an actual measurement, a recent measurement by the Korken group, and they, and an explanation by Misha for the...
Remind the explanation.
Okay. And the key point is that what they have measured is actually some 4 points in this regime. And if you look carefully, I think it's out. I mean, it's not statistically relevant, one has to be fair. But one sees that the first point is a little bit low, and exactly there where we have this maximum, there's also a maximum. But I don't want to overemphasize this here. But the key point is.
It's difficult to line H2.
No, they did it with the circular polarized. Very tricky part.
And correlated measurements.
Yes, exactly.
Very clever.
Yeah.
Very clever.
Exactly. But the key point is that what we see here, according to our prediction, is that the simple model explaining it, there would just be a monotonous thing. And what you see, there's a lot of structure. And if you look in detail, yeah, if you would have not a focal volume averaging, you would see much, much more heavy structure on the ratio. Now, this is to do two things. First of all, to tell you that without using any supercomputer, we can do hundreds of calculations for H2. Now, yeah, just on our small cluster, ourselves. Without parallelization so far. And so this is the ionization yield as a function of nuclear motion for 800 nanometer for parallel orientation. And this is if you multiply it by the ground state vibrational density distribution. And then you see that at the equilibrium distance, of course, not necessarily the high ionization happens. But the key point, what you see is that there's still, even at 800 nanometers, there's a lot of structure in detail. This is the same for perpendicular. And now, this is a ratio parallel to perpendicular for different intensities as a function of internuclear separation. It looks like a complete mess and horror. If you do all the averaging, actually not even all, not even the focal volume, just the R averaging, you get this one, one of these curves, parallel, perpendicular. And a simple atomic one electron single center model, green, which, why not? Yeah, also matches perfectly this behavior. Now, this is the fixed internuclear separation, 1.4 equilibrium distance, but it's, the intensity is shifted for IS reasons by a factor 2. So it would lie here, but it would show structure. Yeah, but remind this.
A single
No, this is two electrons.
No, but
two single
electrons.
The green one is a simple model we proposed to model hydrogen molecule by a single center, one electron effective potential.
Okay. But both people, does the same model work for the perpendicular?
It, of course, gives you an averaged result. You should average perpendiculars, and then the green one should be perfect. I mean, if at all.
Yeah. The green one looks like it's agreeing with the parallel.
No, not everywhere. It has also deficiencies, fortunately. Yes. Sorry, I mean, this was just a late clause of the manuscript.
Right?
Yes. So, forget about these ones.
Forget about those.
So, these three curves are parallel, red, perpendicular, blue, and green is a simple model. Yeah? Which doesn't know about any asphericity of H2. This is for fixed internuclear separation 1.4, but shifted, so it would lie here, but has this additional structure. Now, this is a ratio, yeah, and again, we are not yet at the experimental results, because for the focal volume averaging, but we are getting there, and we see already the trend, which is rather similar. So, I remind you that,
averaging over
internuclear initial separation in a classical or the most simple way. You just take the initial state wave function and multiply, as I described here, you multiply these spectra with that. Yeah? Okay, now about the imaging. Now, of course, this paper is really not about integrated electron spectra, but it is about it's about energy resolved spectra, ATI or photoelectron or electron spectra. Sorry, I'm soon ready. Now, Alfred has already introduced that in a simple strong field approximation velocity gauge LCRO approach, you get a nice interference picture, two-slit experiment picture. Now, the best optimal case you can think of to have the cleanest picture should be H2 at some larger internuclear separation, yeah? Because it's practically two 1s orbitals. So there's no problem with signs and positive, negative, and the molecular orbital is more than just atomic orbitals, whatever. Yeah, it should be rather clean, especially at larger internuclear separations. It's really almost like two hydrogen atoms. So we have shown that what you can do is you can show that the ratio of parallel to perpendicular spectra should behave like cosine square of kr over half. So you should see in this simple strong field approximation velocity gauge LCRO picture, you should see a behavior of the ratio like this. This is for three atomic units to make it even better for this model, to have a good chance to see something. Now, these are the TDSE calculations for a number of intensities. So I would not see any of this. In the best case, you could say it's a 1 over this or a sinus or whatever. But unfortunately, the sinus is for the bonding case not really applicable. So in the full dimensional TDSE, we unfortunately do not see anything of this nice interference velocity SFA result. Now, of course, also, as I said, the inference of nuclear motion on the ATI spectra, again, there you see again this behavior of the potential curve of the binding energy. Yeah? So there is, in some simple models, you get some modeling, yeah, this is even for 400 nanometers. But of course, if you increase intensity, structures get more complicated. But of course, averaging over a lot of degrees of freedom can give you a very simple result. Now, the final remark I would like to do is that if you consider a real molecule, and we have been mentioning this already before, then what you have is a much denser, much higher density of states or levels, orbitals, whatever you want to have in your language, which means that all these simple pictures which have been typically proven or checked for systems like hydrogen atom or H2 nitrogen molecule with a large separation may get into trouble. Now, to make no problem with a single active electron approximation here, consider the simplest case of a more realistic molecule. I mean, this is actually motivated originally by your paper, but for a different wavelength, the B state of hydrogen. Let's start with the B state, the first excited state. And immediately, the spacing to the neighbor levels is completely changed from the ground state. It's much closer. And what you see is that even with 2,000 nanometer wavelengths,
so spectroscopic notation changed.
Oh, sorry.
Is the second excited state.
Ah, B prime was it for me. When did it change? I'm too old, too long gone from this.
Yeah. The first excited, B is the second excited.
But in the original literature, the B state is this one. The sigma
first,
U.
First sigma U state. That's
Yeah.
Prime is the second
I think because of historically these notations were so fixed, I think maybe UPAP changes, but no, no. I'm quite sure that you will find it this way. But never mind the names, anyhow. So even with 2,000 nanometers, you have 7 photons you need to ionize the B state, but still, what you see here is for the most of the spectrum, you see high population of the second excited sigma U state, so a 4 plus 3 Rempe. Only if you go to extremely high intensities, this Rempe is not dominating any longer, and the ionization is independent of that, but then you have saturation. So where is your regime where you can really apply your simple models? Now we can go to 3,000 nanometers, yeah, which makes it more complicated to calculate, but in principle, okay. Now, with 3,000 nanometers, you need 10 photons. So this should be really nice, quasi-static or, yeah, whatever regime. Now here is starting with the B or with the EF state. And what you see is that, in contrast to what you would expect, the ionization of the two states is actually at some points even inverted. So it's not really that you find a simple explanation for two states having completely different binding energies to be behaving like this. Actually, I predicted this in the quasi-static model already a long time ago by just considering the coupling of the B and the EF state in the static field. So actually there you see this crossing, and the point is now, of course, whether you prefer the adiabatic or the diabatic description, whether there's a crossing or whether they stay on the same side. So with this, I finish. I want to emphasize that the analysis and further extension of imaging and control schemes demand a deeper understanding of molecular strong field behavior to minor appreciation. I think we have developed in our group a number of extremely efficient numerical tools, and even did some analytical work on the strong field approximation recently to just initiate by comparing and then trying to understand it. So we have effective 1 and 2 electron atoms we can describe. We can describe effective 1 and 2 electron diatomic molecules and in principle arbitrary molecules within the single active electron approximation. I showed some examples. We can do this, as I said, on standard computers. So we don't need a supercomputer. And the key point is that some simple models work surprisingly nice in strong field, and that's the confusing part. And sometimes they fail miserably. And it's not so trivial to find out when to expect what. Yeah? There are some guidelines, but not really strict, and that's a problem. So if I summarize imaging aspects, then I would say the orientation-dependent total ionization yield may already provide some structural information, like also Andre has emphasized. But the question is, of course, how to get it on a sub-femtosecond timescale if you want to make it very fancy. Now, recollision-based data, rescattered electrons, high harmonics, have to be folded with the structural information already contained in the initial wave packet. That's a complication. The often implied averages, focal volume, internuclear separation, etc., may lead sometimes to seemingly simpler pictures. But of course, the question, do you have really control about the lost information? Or is it just you may think your nice simple model would explain things properly? So in conclusion, I would say the intense laser field response of a molecule definitely contains structural information, but maybe too much. Thank you very much.
I just want to understand your multi-electron molecules ionization. How was this? What is this method approach? How do you get it? Is it using the
single active electron?
I see. But then you do the single active electron for many different orbitals.
Yes. We can just freeze different orbitals in our approach.
Is this like a superposition with the spectra that you show, which show the result for starting from different orbitals?
You should take, yes.
Or is it, should this also have a quantum mechanical?
Of course, in principle, now it's a problem of, you do some model, the single active electron model, and then of course you have to analyze your results within this model. So as I said, you can heuristically include a factor 2 for H2 and find that it works quite nice. For the different orbitals, you of course, you don't know the phases because you treat everything separately. You do one full time propagation for one orbital as initial point, so you have to incoherently sum. I wouldn't know any better way without knowing any more from this model. So of course, as I emphasize again, I don't want to be saying to you single active electron approximation is the solution to everything because we have a code now. Yeah? I just want to say, okay, we can do it, we can give you a reference result, and we can try to see whether it works. And there are, for example, I showed you for the oxygen or nitrogen orientation dependent ionization, it seems to work very nicely. For CO2, there seems to be a problem. I don't know whether experimental or, but there we also see in our calculation problem from the single active electron approximation. And this indicates to me that, yeah, this is probably the key point here, that we see the onset of not one electron effects, even in the single active electron calculation.
And I have one more technical question, which relates to your remark that you can do this on a small computer, and it's Freuling and Andre, who tells us that you need 10 to the 14 points on these big supercomputers. So where is the miracle? Why you can do it on Google?
I think he could also, but the point is simply that he's using a different approach. Now, of course, you have always to compromise.
Yeah, I mean, if you just count the ionization, you just need a small box.
Exactly.
On one generation, ATR, et cetera, you need a big box.
So the point is, okay, one thing is the box. One thing is that we don't use a grid, but a B-spline basis, which helps already. But the key point is, I really want to emphasize, is the expansion and field-free eigenstates. Now, the key point of that is that you have some kind of physical way of choosing configurations and configuration space. So it's not just the configuration space, but also phase space, because you have an energy criterion, typically. So what we normally do is we check convergence with the number of states we include, of course, with the box size, et cetera, this comes also, but with the number of states we include up to a certain energy. And this shows very important, because depending, and this is exactly, I agree completely with Andre, it depends really on the physics you're looking at. So now, if you really want to have everything, you have to do everything. But if you are not asking for everything, you can use simplifications. But the key point is that these simplifications are still exact in the sense for what you are looking for. You have to converge the quantity you are looking at. So the nice thing with our approach, I think, is that you have, if you define an objective, you may be coming away with much less computational resources. And I think this is very important I think the grid methods are also very important, of course, as a comparison. But I think and for 2 electron ionization, etc., I think you will probably not gain too much here. Some maybe, maybe not. But the key point is that, as I said, having the possibility now to calculate, yeah, all these points quickly allows us to analyze things not just by doing, oh, we use one pulse and we get this result and compare it with different approximation and we find something. Yeah, ADK works, ADK doesn't work, SFA works, SFA doesn't work. Yeah, or the model seems to be fine or not. Yeah, the point is that we have a method that we can really provide a lot of detailed informations quickly. Yeah, and with this we get more insight whether there is more or not in the system. Yeah, it's complementary to the grid methods, definitely. Yeah, but I think it's a nice way to, with few resources, to get a lot of information. As I said, with the grid you get everything finally. Yeah, but you have to do it, and as Andre said, he has explained to you what you need in computational resources. Yeah.
Thank you.
you work with?
Yes. In your singular electron model, in which potential does your electron move?
Yes. Here it is really the one from the ground state calculation. There is, of course, arguments for the ionic one.
Yes, but yeah?
No, no, it's the LV94. It's DFT.
It's a cone sham.
It's a cone sham. And the idea is that we have, however, an orbital which has been checked for the one electron or single photon ionization by Piero. It has been used before and checked with many other functionals. That with the LV94, you have this correct proper long range behavior. And this is, of course, crucial. So we have done in this paper, you find other functionals and how disastrous they. Yeah. Of course. Yeah, but I mean, we just want to make sure that we have checked that. Yeah, you have to be careful with the functional.
So you take the constant potential,
yes,
and you also enforce the penalty to occupied space.
Yes. Okay. But this is a. But there we come exactly to the crucial point that this we have just the manuscript. Also, I mean, we have a number of manuscripts, so it should be submitted immediately. Where we show that actually this is exactly for CO2, giving you an indication whether the single active electron approximation is maybe getting into trouble. Yeah? Okay. So, okay, because of this, if you agree.
There is this one developed technique in solid state physics that's called single detections.
Yes.
And I think this has been generalized to the time attending case as well. Carsten Ulrich.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a bit different from,
yes,
what you're doing.
Right? Yes.
So
yes.
In particular, these single detections are non-local.
Depending on how you define it, there are many different ways. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, is this better what you're doing in some sense, or why you're doing what you're doing?
Yes. Now, okay. The first pragmatical answer is because when I some times ago heard what Piero is doing, I realized that if we just join forces, we have without any big trouble as usual. It's much more than in practice, but in principle, we can do it very quickly by merging the two approaches which we have at hand. And then for this purpose, we would do that. Now, as I said, I have left it out here. There is a subtle point on the gauge independence. And there the point is, as is known, depending on your pseudo potential, you need, first of all, you need a local one to not run into problems with the gauge dependence. Now, here the things are more subtle. The things are such that in H2, we are completely gauge independent, and in the other systems, we are not. And you can, of course, always create a pseudo potential, which is local, and which will be gauge independent. And this is exactly what we have just explored. And first of all, of course, as usual, you learn by making the error. Yeah, I mean, I was saying, okay, I thought it should be, because it's a static potential, it should be gauge independent. And we checked it carefully for H2, and there's lots of efforts, and it was gauge independent. And then the new student, starting on the larger systems, checked it again for H2. And I assumed, believed, he also did it for the others, but he didn't. And then in the end of his diploma thesis, there was some strange results we got. Not always, but at some points, the orientational dependence was very weird. Unfortunately, there was also, as usual, a nice physical explanation, but it was weird. And finally, I said, OK, but you have done this gauge check. And he said, no, I did it for H2, and so it should be OK. And then, yeah, then he did it for nitrogen, oxygen, CO2, water, and it was not gauge independent any longer. And we had a little bit of a hard time to understand, but finally it was rather quickly, I think we have understood it. Why? But this comes exactly to this point now. So you can, afterwards say, this is a big drawback here. On the other hand, as I said, you can turn it optimistically by saying you see already, because we can explain why it occurs, you see the problems of the single active electron approximation in this case. If you make a pseudo-potential, as you said yourself, if you make a nice pseudo-potential, this will be non-local, because it's good, and then you will run into the same trouble. If you, then I, for us, it's not a practical gain, yeah, because we have all these tools much easier. Or if you do a pseudo-potential which is local, you don't have the trouble, and I think Lars Madsen has now pursued this way, just fitting the density. But then, of course, you have a bad or not so good potential. Yeah, and actually it compromises a lot what I saw just recently. Yeah, so as usual, it's a big compromise. If you do a strange approximation, you have to be living with the strange consequences.
Yeah. Regarding your nice whole weighting affair.
Yes.
So you attribute it to the ionization dependence on the coordinate.
Yes.
In addition, polarization of the molecule depends on the coordinate as well.
Of course.
So the usual Raman effect should give you the same coherent tessellation in the ground state. So how can you tell the difference?
Yes. Ah, another talk. No, sorry. This is what I left out, really. Now, if you translate languages and you have many, many photons, then your Raman, your far off resonant, I mean, many, many, many photons off resonant Raman process is actually bond softening. Yeah? And now, here I was in a win-win situation, because I predicted Lovras and I predicted bond softening for neutral H2. So in that sense, I can of course claim, okay, whatever comes out is nice. And actually the experimentalists were, but I have to admit that I like this much more, it's much more fancy than this. And but nevertheless, the key point was that the experimentalists used our model, actually both models, as we did, to get what for their experimental parameters, because they were different from the from our prediction, whether they would see this or that. And they said they see bond softening, because it would be much larger for the intensities they've used, which were lower than ours, than our effect. Not much, but say above almost an order of magnitude. The problem was, so it should at least be similar. Now the point was that they made a mistake. They forgot the classical averaging over the space, and then you get a factor 12 down and so on. But of course, I admit that it was of course difficult to be sure, because the model we have is rather simple. So the nice thing of errors is that you can learn. So because they were very much insisting that it's bond softening, because as I said, they were just thinking that this Lovras is a very strange effect, that they were really keeping, okay, but okay, then it's factor 5 smaller or so, but how do you know, yeah, and I said myself, the model is of course very rough, yeah. So we sat together, discussing this, and it turned out from the simulations, and now I make a cartoon which don't take serious, yeah. It gives you somehow an easy explanation, but as often, easy explanations are wrong, but it's a nice explanation. Now, if you want to distinguish between these two effects, either the R dependence of the ionization rate, depletion, or bond softening, meaning a distortion of the potential curve, then you can think of it the following way. If you go from your ground state, your initial state, or very bad cartoon of that, and you make Lovras, you eat away in the maximum of the field in the outer part. If you have bond softening, the wave packet will move outwards. So at the same time, here there should be the depletion in the inner side, which means that in one case you push your pendulum, and in the other case you pull it and release it. Now, of course, the key point is, what does it mean experimentally? Because this means a situation at zero, yeah, where the two passes actually are overlapping and you don't have any effect at all. So the question is, can you discover this phase? And actually, the funny thing was, and this is why they liked finally this whole thing so much, because it turned out that the experiment was much better than they even believed themselves before. Because it was so stable, the oscillation they found, that they could really go back in time. I don't have the graph here, but if they really, they can, in the meantime, they can go to thousands oscillations. They visualized thousands oscillations with a like a clock. Yeah. But they keep on, even there, they had about 50 or so. And now they have these points. And the key point is that they are really lying on a complete straight line. So their interferometer to produce this copy of the replica of the initial pulse is so perfect that it's really a nice curve and you can really extrapolate down to zero. And if you do this, you get really the experimental results are the points. And now if you would have bond softening, you should have the dashed one. If you have Lochfras, you should have the chain one, which is almost a green. And if you take both effects together, you should get the solid line. Now, I admit that I'm actually a little bit puzzled by the quality of the solid line agreeing with the others, because it's really the one you get if you just mix the two from the simple model. Yeah? It uses not ADK, but DC ionization rates, but still, it's a very simple model. Yeah. So, but the key point is that you see from the phase, from the absolute phase, yeah, that it definitely does not allow a dominant bond softening. Now, as I said, don't take this sketch too seriously, but if you do the numerical analysis, you will find a rather similar picture as you see here from the offset of the phases. So this is a way to distinguish. And the same way has been used by Gibson for the iodine experiment. I don't know.
We're going to start again.
Yes.
In an hour, so.
Sorry for stretching your time.